You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. Really pleased to have with me John Rubino once again. For those of you who aren't familiar with his website, you sure should be. It's dollarcollapse.com. He is the author of several books, John is. Several books, but the one I think that's probably most germane apropos to the topics discussed on this show is the money bubble, what to do before it pops. And that was co-authored with James Turk of Gold Money. John is certainly a good friend. He's one of the nicest people I know. He is also one of the smartest and most articulate when it comes to explaining happenings on Wall Street. So, John, thank you so much for joining us again.
Hey, Jay, good to talk to you again. And as always, there's a lot to talk about.
Well, there's too much. My wife reminds me I should shut my pie hole and let my guests talk. So I'm going to try to do that. I've titled today's show America's Economic Decline and Rising Geopolitical Tensions. First of all, inflation definitely seems to be on the rise. My inflation deflation watch keeps hitting new highs every week. What are your thoughts? Is it a serious inflation problem we have, or can we trust the Fed, who gives us assurances that they'll never let inflation get out of hand?
Well, we of course can't trust the Fed. We know that by now. They basically, what their job is to say words that make the stock market go up, which is basically, you know, completely focus grouped. In other words, they have to do that because the system is too over indebted to tolerate an equities bear market now. In other words, if stocks tank, it's not just something that's confined to the stock market. It can blow up the whole economy. So their job is to keep the financial markets happy and optimistic. And so you can't ever trust what they say because they have an agenda that is not related to the truth necessarily. So the inflation deflation thing is really interesting right now because massive amounts of debt, which we have taken on over the last 30 years, are inherently deflationary. In other words, because you've got to pay interest on that debt and you have to pay it back, it takes money away from what you would have been used otherwise for productive investment and growth. So it slows the economy down. That's deflationary. Mm-hmm. However, all the new money that has to be created to keep that mountain of debt from turning into another Great Depression is inflationary. So we've got these two forces right now contending out there. And lately, the inflationary forces have been winning. The governments of the world have been creating so much new currency and just dumping it into the system that all that new currency is forcing prices of a lot of things up. And whereas it used to just be stocks, bonds, and real estate that were going up, which makes it easier to fool us into thinking there's no inflation because those things don't appear in the consumer price index. The government doesn't count them as inflation. But lately, other stuff has been going up, like food, you know, and lumber. The price of a new house has gone way up because lumber has tripled. It's on its way to quadrupling now, apparently. And then iron ore and copper. So there's lots of other things that are getting more expensive, which do impact day-to-day life and the consumer price index. So this next year will be really interesting when these numbers start coming out and they're above the Fed's 2% inflation target. And meanwhile, the Fed is saying, oh, it's just temporary. Don't worry. We've got it under control. But then people are seeing their cost of living go up by 3 or 4 or 5 or 6% a year. And it'll be interesting to see what market sentiment then turns into. When the Fed is contradicting what we see with our eyes every day, we'll see if we still trust them.
Mm-hmm. Well, there seems to be almost nobody in Washington anymore. The Republicans used to be the party of prudence and fiscal responsibility, at least to an extent. Other than two or three senators, there doesn't seem to be many around anymore that are very much opposed, especially when their president, when their party's in power in Washington, but even now with the Biden spending, which is just going nuts, absolutely crazy, So there's this modern monetary theory. It seems as though there is the belief that you can always create endless amounts of money to finance things. Governments are omnipotent, omniscient. They have all those characteristics that's ascribed to deity. What about modern monetary theory? And could you explain that to our listeners? And how does that differ from QE that we had after 2008?
Well, modern monetary theory is the idea that this whole, we'll borrow money and then we'll spend that money and then we'll pay interest on that debt that's out there, doesn't really have to happen. Because all we have to do, if you're a government with a printing press, all you have to do is just print the money and spend it. And so their idea is that we can so simplify life by just having the government print as much money as it needs and spend it. Now, we don't have any taxes. We don't have any bonds out there. There's no debt from the government or anything. It's just them borrowing it or creating it and spending it. But of course, the fatal flaw lies with the phrase as much money as it needs, right? Because then we're telling the government to go ahead and spend as much as it feels like it needs, which means infinite amounts, because there's always going to be a war to fight. There's always going to be an election that has to be bought. There's always going to be infinite numbers of other things that a government could spend money on in order to buy votes. So you give them unlimited amounts of money and they will spend unlimited amounts of money. And then supply and demand kicks in and the value of each individual piece of that currency starts to fall and the system collapses. But I should say that, we're already most of the way there, because what we do now is the government borrows money and spends it by issuing bonds. And the Fed then buys those bonds with newly created currency and holds them, and then rebates the interest on those bonds back to the government. So in effect, we're already doing modern monetary theory. So it's not, it sounds like a new thing, but it's not really a new thing. It's just a ratification of what we're doing already. And remember, modern monetary theory was going to cause a disaster if we ever implement it. So the fact that we have kind of implemented it means we have that disaster heading our way pretty soon.
Well, there's always been the economist that that have thought that that was the way out, and that why can't it work forever? Alistair MacLeod has talked on this show about the Mississippi bubble, John Law, and that whole thing, and he's really equated MMT to that. He, obviously it didn't work. Eventually, it didn't work. But let's try to think through this. Why? Interest rates should be rising now if inflation is rising, right?
Yeah, well, they have been rising. The 10-year yield, the 10-year treasury, is up from 0.7% to 1.5-something percent now, and it was as high as 1.7%. So that was a 100 basis point increase in a year. So, the markets were responding to the perception of higher inflation. So the question going forward is, will inflation continue to rise, and will the markets respond as they logically ought to by demanding a higher interest rate? And that remains to be seen, but I think there's a pretty good chance that that's the way it plays out.
All right. So if the market once more, first of all, if all the treasuries are being purchased by the government or by the Fed, financed by the Fed, why would interest rates have to go up? It's no longer a free market. It's not really a market. It's managed by the government, right?
Well, there's still a lot of lending going on out there. Even if we just eliminate the government bond market, there's still business loans and personal loans and other things like that. So people are lending money for which they expect a positive real return. In other words, they want to make money above the inflation rate. So if the inflation rate starts to rise because governments are creating way too much new currency, which is to say, if the value of those currencies start to fall, what inflation is, then people lending money out there, whether they're lending it to you or me or IBM or GM or whoever, they're going to want a rate of return on their lending that exceeds the inflation rate. And if the inflation rate goes up, lenders are going to want a higher interest rate. So that's how interest rates go up. That's the mechanism when they rise due to inflation. And if we went full MMT, and inflation would inevitably start increasing dramatically then interest rates would have to go up to compensate. Now, one thing the Fed could do is just buy up all the debt that's out there in the system, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Push down interest rates that way by buying up everybody's bonds. But then that would mean even more money is being dumped into the system, which would accelerate inflation, which means that any lending that did take place out there would still have to be at a higher interest rate. So that's not a fix, you know, having the government just force interest rates down basically just shifts the pressure to a different part of the economy, but it's still, you know, the pressure of oversupply. Somehow it has to break out. And that's what, you know, that's what we're inevitably going to get because we've already done the damage. Now it's just a question of how does that damage manifest in the financial world? And so it could be a crashing currency or soaring interest rates or tanking stocks or soaring stocks. You know, it could be the crack up boom where the price of everything just goes through the roof. We don't know, but we know it will be chaotic because it always has been in human history. Companies or countries have done this dozens, if not hundreds of times in the past, made these same mistakes. And it always ends up in some kind of a really chaotic hyperinflation or deflationary crash. One of those two things happens every time. So there's no reason to think this will be a different time.
But the ignorance of free market economics, they don't teach it in our schools. We're supposed to be a capitalist country, but if you talk to people in the streets, they haven't a clue about how even simple things like supply and demand curves and how people respond to that. It seems as though these problems, which are brought on by government intervention, beget more dislocations, which then invites even more government intervention. And ultimately, I mean, I hear what you're saying about the interest rates and why lenders will require higher rates as the inflation rate as their currency loses its purchasing power. But then, you know, in steps government to fix things because people holler and scream about higher interest rates. And so, you know, where does this thing end? And what I'm trying to say is they don't allow the market to adjust. And the further we go with this, the further we go with the intervention, the further we are away from a return to some sort of the economy that is productive and wealth creating. Yeah. So does and you mentioned a crack up boom. Maybe just define that term for people. That is an Austrian school idea. Crack up boom. Are we seeing a crack up boom? I mean, my inflation deflation is index is going straight up now, pretty much. But it includes both commodities and stocks and basically everything. So what is a crack up boom is when things just go absolutely nuts, like the tulip mania, I suppose, would be an example.
Well, yeah, a crack up boom is where a critical mass of people figure out that it's the government's explicit policy to make the currency worth less year after year. And they just bail on the currency. They don't want to hold something that's depreciating at an accelerating rate. So what they do is they buy real stuff. They look around and think, okay, what can the government not just make more of out of thin air? Yeah. Well, farmland and oil wells and gold and silver and rental houses. People start buying those things. Which forces the prices of those things just through the roof. So you see, you know, it manifests as inflation, soaring prices. But what's actually happening is a loss of faith in the currency. People are just giving up on that currency. And then the system breaks down because a government without a currency that anybody trusts can't function as a government anymore. And and so then you get a huge bust, usually preceded by a big inflation, then a huge bust. And, you know, that's, again, that's not some mystical, magical thing that needs some kind of a metaphysics to be believed in. This is just what happens over and over again. If you Google hyperinflation or list of hyperinflations, that's the thing you want to Google, you will get this long list of country names with big numbers beside them, which is the amount that their currency was depreciated by, you know, 420,000% or whatever. And it's a long list, and it's a lot of countries that we've heard of and everything. And those are just the mistakes that countries have made in the past, which blew up their currencies. And we're basically doing the same thing. So, we don't really have free markets anymore in the sense that free markets require good information on the part of the players and price discovery. Mm-hmm. In other words, you can tell what something is worth because the market is sending you signals that tell you to buy more of it or to produce more of it or whatever. We've killed that price signaling mechanism by manipulating markets. You know, we pushed interest rates down to unnatural levels and created huge amounts of new currency and intervened in markets when markets should have been able to have crashes in order to wipe out the bad mm-hmm. business models and the unmanageable debt to get back to some kind of normality. Well, we've stopped all that. So the markets mm-hmm. don't work anymore. So we're not really a capitalist system, which means capitalist systems are very flexible. They respond to changes mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. With positive actions, which maintain more or less equilibrium.
If there's one market in which price discovery is most important, it's the price discovery of capital. I mean, how can we have capitalism if you're not allowed to know what the cost of capital is, which is exactly what the Fed is doing? It's interfering with the cost of capital. You would agree with that.
Oh, yeah, because the interest rate, which is what you have to pay to borrow, that tells you something if you're an entrepreneur. If money is very cheap, it tells you borrow and build a big factory, build a productive asset. If money is very expensive, in other words, if interest rates are really high, that tells you, you know, don't borrow right now. Just operate with what you've got or even cut back some. And that allows the system to adjust to changing environments and continue to be productive and to increase its productivity. But if you push interest rates down below a natural level, you know, in other words, artificially low, then entrepreneurs don't know what to do. You know, you're kind of telling them to borrow a ton of money, but they can't find anything productive to do with it, so they do less productive things, or they do really frivolous things. Same thing with individuals, you know. If mortgage rates go down to 2%, then that's telling you to buy a house, right? Whether you can really afford a house or not, whether you should have a big house, but it tells you to do that. Mm-hmm. And when those signals are coming out that are telling us to borrow money, but use that money for unproductive purposes, mm-hmm. that's the end point in the Austrian economic business cycle. That's when they call that the Ponzi stage of the process, mm-hmm. when money is being borrowed just to pay the interest on previous borrowings and to do frivolous, silly stuff, you know, big vacations, hot cars, huge houses. And that's where we are now as a society. We're borrowing to spend money on things that mostly don't increase the productivity of society because interest rates are telling us to do that, you know, and that's the thing that will eventually blow us up, you know, where we're creating so much bad debt that at some point even the government won't be able to bail us out of all this bad debt. And we'll realize that the game is over because even the guys in charge don't have any tools left to fix this.
John, with all of this money creation, what we've seen is a redistribution of wealth from the middle class to the wealthy, to the really super rich. Some statistics I just came across said the five largest banks in the U.S., there's something like $2.5 trillion more in there's $2.5 trillion more in deposits than in loans being made. This is since 2008. So we have this huge gap. Money stays in the financial system and is used. Deposits, I suppose, and treasuries and so forth, but it fuels the financial markets. The money isn't being lent out. I mean, it's a real problem. So the real economy doesn't see the stimulus that's coming through the monetary system. And the author of this article I was reading is suggesting that could change pretty soon, and that if he's sort of tying this idea that if there was tapering to quantitative easing, that is, if the Fed started getting a bit more stingy, that would cause the banks to start to lend more. Do you see any prospect of that?
Well, the banks have plenty of money to lend if they want to, but the problem is
rates.
Yeah. Well, we divided society into basically two groups here. One group is the very rich and the people who work online, and they've done really well during the pandemic. And during the previous 20 years. but they don't need to borrow any more money. They're making money hand over fist. So they're not great customers for the bank because, yes, they'll borrow money, but only at insanely low rates. Like they'll borrow money for 0%, but that doesn't help a bank. And then the rest of the country, you know, small businesses, like if you're a restaurant owner or something like that, are you a good credit for a bank to lend to? No, mm-hmm. no bank wants to lend to you because they we might go back into lockdown and your yep. restaurant will fail again. So banks don't really have a lot of people to lend money to. Which is, you know, that's part of the impact of artificially low interest rates. It stratifies society into a small group of haves and a gigantic group of have-nots. And yep. nowhere in there is a bunch of people who are good for banks to lend money to, right? Because you want somebody who can pay you back and who can afford a pretty high interest rate and is willing to pay it. There aren't very many people like that anymore.
No, John, and we're just about out of time here, so I want to get on to a couple of other ideas yet if it's time. So we have this disparity of wealth, and we have, it seems like, growing discontent in America. Lots of people living under bridges, homeless. It's really a mess in many ways. Can that have some impact, though? A lot of times countries that have troubles at home decide to get involved in things overseas. Are you concerned at all about potential issues with China and with Russia, for example, Russia and the Ukraine and China over Taiwan?
Yeah, today's geopolitics fit that script really well. When you screw up your domestic system, either financially or some other way, one of the temptations is to look abroad for an enemy, mm-hmm. Start something with them, and distract your people from your own mismanagement. So mm-hmm. as much as we've mismanaged our domestic economies around the world, you might expect for different countries to be bumping up against each other out there and kind of picking fights as a way of distracting their own people. And you're seeing it everywhere now. You know, we're virtually in shooting wars with Russia and China right now. Like, we're right there, you know, close mm-hmm. to it happening. And the Middle East, of course, is always a powder keg. And we're stirring things up over there, too, you know, in Afghanistan and Syria and Iran. So, yeah, we're behaving in ways that would be kind of expected given our domestic financial situations. But this is so much more of a dangerous world. You know, you can't play these games without immense risk in today's world, with everybody having nuclear weapons and all kinds of other weapons. You know, we can do cyber attacks now and chemical weapon attacks and EMP attacks. And, you know, there's just so much that can happen in a shooting war that has never happened before. So we have no idea how this is going to play out. And we have to pray that all they're doing is just saber rattling. And they understand that if push comes to shove, they're going to back off. But you never know with these guys, you know.
Well,
look at World War One. That is a terrible
harbinger
of what might come.
All right, John, we're just about out of time here. We're going to have to leave it go at that, I'm afraid. But certainly wars mean more money printing. I think there's nowhere to go to start with financially than to start with gold and silver and gold and silver shares, I guess. Real quickly, 20 seconds.
Oh, you totally want to have precious metals in every possible form in this kind of an environment. Physical gold and silver at home, mining shares to replace your tech stocks. Absolutely.
All right. We'll have to leave it go at that, John. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks,
Jay. We'll look to do it again sometime real soon. Well, next week, folks, Alistair MacLeod will join me to explain why he thinks the world is inevitably destined to return to a gold and or silver-backed monetary system. And that means for the kind of investments, we'll ask him what that means for the kind of investments you might want to look at. I think John just sort of answered that question. Also, we're going to have an executive from Firefox Mining Corp that seems to be on to a grand new high-grade discovery, another Quentin Henning-related company. And also Michael Oliver will be with us next week as well. So until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.